Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it's shaped our thoughts on a new release. I'm Tasha Robinson, here once again with Scott Tobias, Rachel Handler, Keith Phipps, and behind-the-scenes producer Genevieve Kosky. This week we're talking about Battle Royale, Kenji Fukasaku's 2000 horror thriller about teenagers forced to fight to the death by a corrupt and coercive government that wants to keep its citizens frightened and helpless. On the last episode, we talked about the Battle Royale Hunger Games controversy, Battle Royale's camp elements, and how it works as metaphor. This time around, we're going to bring the Hunger Games movies more to the forefront, as Mockingjay Part 2 looms in the immediate future, wrapping up the series that began in 2012 with the first Hunger Games movie, directed by Gary Ross, and starring Jennifer Lawrence, Josh Hutcherson, and Liam Hemsworth. Again, as a heads up, none of us have seen Mockingjay Part 2 yet, because it won't screen here in Chicago until 2 days before its release. So we're talking here about the series as a whole, with everyone invited to bring a topic to link the two films. Keith, you want to start?
Let's talk about the style of the films, the Hunger Games series versus Battle Royale, which is interesting. I found at times Battle Royale almost played like a slasher film, and maybe it's because they were in the woods so much, but there's definitely sort of the things popping out of nowhere to kill you element of it. It seemed a little more chaotic, a little more in the middle of the action. I've actually only seen one other Fukasaku film, and that is not necessarily one for probably top of his resume. It's called Message from Space, which is his 1978 Star Wars ripoff, which was sort of like neatly has some neat designs to it, and is almost totally incomprehensible, but really a lot of fun. But it also has this kind of like, a lot of the battle scenes are very much like almost like combat footage, where you're kind of there in the middle of the action. You're kind of, you know, stuck in there. The point of view is very close to the characters. And I found that style is very consistent with Battle Royale, however different the films are. The Hunger Games series is interesting because I think they're all more or less the same style. I think Gary Ross introduces a style that Francis Lawrence improves upon in many ways, which is very handheld, also close to the action, but also things feel very thought out. Tasha used the word cold to describe them, which I think is an appropriate way.
Yeah, for me, there's just this like this cold, muted color precision to the whole thing that has become kind of the de facto look of like YA dystopian films. Like you see it again in The Hunger Games and The Host and The Giver, which is a story that it didn't fit in at all, and the Divergent movies. I mean, it's like people now think that is the style they have to shoot in.
Yeah.
And it feels like it was influenced a little bit by Catherine Hardwicke's Twilight, but that film is so like blue-gray. It does a completely different thing with color palette, and it's an even chillier film than this one. This one feels less like physically cold and more just sterile and aseptic.
Yeah, I think it's also a little bit influenced by, and appropriately so, by reality television, where it's the handheldness of it, but there's also this sort of sense of handheld camera work that's hitting these very precise marks because it ends on these really nicely, you know, striking compositions. I mean, I like the style of the films, the Hunger Games films, quite a bit. I like the style of Battle Royale too, but they are quite different. And I think those differences play out in the way the films work as well.
Yeah, I feel like the Hunger Games films are kind of embracing this like paranoid paranoid, oppressive aesthetic where they're constantly hitting the point that everybody's being watched at all times. You know, it's much more a like a paranoid panopticon movie where you have this like oppressive dystopic thing that's not just forcing you to do things you don't want to do, but looking at you at all times. And that's something they really push into the foreground in the later films. Whereas Battle Royale, as we've kind of commented before, has the idea at the beginning that the society is aware of this, that journalists are embracing it or excited about it or at least taking advantage of it, but much less of that sensation of voyeurism and like everything you do, all of your suffering is being enjoyed by outside forces. Scott, what's your take on the style of the Hunger Games films?
I don't think they have much of a style. I mean, Keith detailed it so well that I hate to contradict him. And I do recall, again, it's been a little bit of time since I've seen the first Hunger Games. It had been when it came out. But there was the scene where the reaping, what do they call it? The harvest? What is
the
it?
The reaping, yeah.
The reaping, where you do have a little bit of handheld and it's supposed to be in, you know, coal country and, you know, a little bit rough. But this is Gary Ross, you know. And I also feel like so many of these franchises, you know, they operate more like television than they do film. I don't think they're striking stylistically. I think they establish a template, and that template is followed from one film to the next. And I think what Francis Lawrence does is a little bit different than what Ross does, but I don't think it's much different from, you know, Lawrence's other films. I don't think the look of the film is that much different from Water for Elephants or, you know, the I Am Legend. Was that him? I Am Legend with Will Smith.
Yes.
So I mean, it's just got that kind of. It's got the usual sort of like sort of DV slickness. I don't really see. I don't find the look of the films striking at all.
You wouldn't even call them films, would you?
No, they're barely films. They're just projected television.
I do think stylistically that the second two Hunger Games movies are more consistent. I mean, obviously it's the same director, but mm-hmm. I just think that that's noticeable. I think that they're much more sort of darker, and both literally and figuratively, they're sadder and they're bleaker, and the color palette's bleaker. I think you introduced me to the dystopian YA novel Twitter account. I can't find the tweet that I'm looking for, but there was something about like I'm wearing my gray tunic, like that's become a trope and like almost a joke at this point, that's the color palette.
Oh yeah, like in the oppressive future of YA dystopia, like wearing colors will not be
right.
permitted. That's a really fun Twitter, by the way.
It's great. Yeah,
well, I think we can also say though that in terms of the palette of these films, it differs from where you are. I mean, it's not really a matter of style exactly for me, but almost production design, you know, and what the way certain areas are going to look, the way the city looks. What do they call it?
Capital.
They call the city. It's like what, Syracuse or something. And then
the Syracuse,
and,
they call
and,
it.
And then in the districts, that they have a different look too. And so
I don't know. I'm just wondering if we need to throw down over Gary Ross or not, because I Gary Ross directed Pleasantville, which mm-hmm. is very good.
I know he's good.
Mm-hmm. Seabiscuit.
But would you say
good.
That
and
he's got a
also
strong
film
personal
that's really
style.
Striking thing
well,
with style?
I think Pleasantville is a very, very attractive looking movie. Mm-hmm. I don't know what makes it a Gary Ross film. I know we get into that whole thing, mm-hmm. but it's quite accomplished.
I like it. I like it too.
Gary Ross wrote Big. Gary Ross wrote Dave.
I like Dave.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he can write movies that like the entire world finds memorable without necessarily being a talented visual stylist in a way that satisfies Scott. I really do think, like from long experience with Scott, that Scott has a much higher bar for what makes a film cinematic in terms, particularly in terms of camera framing, than just about any film critic I know.
No, I don't know. There are people that are much more ridiculous
yes,
than
but
I am.
I don't know them.
Yes, you only know my ridiculousness.
I'm just saying, I don't think that his framing unnecessarily obviates any of his accomplishments. But I am with Keith on, like, Pleasantville in particular is so memorable visually, and particularly memorable in, like, what it does with color, what it does with cinematography.
And it's a gray color contrast, just mm-hmm. like in the Hunger Games films, right?
Yeah. So
it's an authorial stamp.
Yeah.
Gary Ross is an auteur.
I will say this by way of more Gary Ross bashing. I do recall seeing Catching Fire and thinking instantly, like, oh, this is in the hands of a better director now. Like, mm-hmm. this is like,
and, we're, and what was it for you?
I think it begins with a scene. The Catching Fire begins with them in the woods, her and the one who's not really small, the taller one, Liam Hemsworth.
Gale. The one who's not really small.
You can call him Dark Boy and Blonde Boy.
Not Honey Crisp, which is our name for Josh Hutcherson, because he has to stand on apple boxes. We nicknamed him Honey Crisp, Genevieve and I. I thought it was a pretty good one.
Awesome.
But I really hope it catches on, because it's so cute. He's like Honey Crisp, right? You look at him now, it's a perfect nickname.
I hope the one who's not so small catches on.
I'm just going to start calling him Apple Box.
The one who's not so small.
That's like a dystopian YA name right there.
Like in all caps, right.
Oh, she has spoken to the one who is not so small.
It's a Terry Pratchett character name, to be fair.
What the hell was I saying? Well, okay, so I was saying that at the beginning of Catching Fire, it's like, okay, we're in the hands of somebody who technically is a more, you know, proficient filmmaker, because I feel like you get that scene in the woods. I think there's like something happened with the sun a little bit there. It's like a very visually striking, you know, dynamically filmed sequence, and you know, it's my favorite of the three by far. I don't know about the rest.
Rachel, where do you stand on the great Gary Ross controversy? Like, do you actually feel a difference between Hunger Games and the other films?
I do. Yeah, I definitely do. I mean, I think I felt the same way. I read all the Hunger Games books. I was kind of iffy about them, but I was excited because Jennifer Lawrence to see the movies. Mm-hmm. I think the first one I was sort of not really impressed by. And then the second, the further along it got in the series, the more into it I was. And by the third one, I was totally hooked and, you know, sobbing in the theater, although it takes nothing for me to cry in a movie. So.
Well, there is one big difference, I think, is both as the series progresses, and a big difference between Hunger Games and Battle Royale. And Scott, that plays into the topic you wanted to bring up.
That would be violence. my beloved violence. You know, yes, my topic is violence, which I enjoy violence. One big problem I have with the Hunger Games movies. Is the violence. I mean, here's a movie about, or a series of movies about a bunch of kids killing each other, and there's hardly a drop of blood in it. It's completely sanitized to get a PG-13 rating. Battle Royale, on the other hand, fought through bans, censorship, controversy, in order to show how a scenario like that would really play out. You know, and of course, my problem with Hunger Games is a problem I have with American action movies, period. We accept this sanitized, bloodless violence as the norm, and it contributes to a culture that doesn't understand what real violence looks like. You know, so I understand, again, it's a commercial thing. The kids have to come see this movie, The Hunger Games. But it's a problem. I mean, it's a problem. And in knowing that context, knowing the context of what our rating system is and what kind of audience they want for these movies, it doesn't lessen the fact that it's wrong for the films. And I think we should really be able to see what kids killing each other looks like.
Were the subsequent films in the series also rated PG-13?
The subsequent films in
the Hunger Games series.
Yeah, they're all. None of them are.
Because it seems to me that, like, the series, the source material, the series gets darker and darker as it progresses, and it feels to me like the films do as well. I associated that partially with the change of directors, but I also just associated with the fact that the first film was such a success. Like, a successful film gives you a lot more leeway to trust your director, to trust your team, to trust that whatever you put in that film, people are going to accept. People are not going to question it as much or resist it as much. And it seems to me that when the first Hunger Games movie came out, there was a pretty big controversy about, you know, how are they going to handle kids killing kids on screen? And the answer was, let's do it as, like, decorously and briefly as possible, especially with the first big massacre. There's just sort of an aesthetic feel that's like, the camera got bumped and everything's jumbled and a bunch of people died, and now let's get to the sad, decorous mourning part. So, like, it just seems to me that as the film series has gone on, they've trusted in the violence more, but at the same time, maybe it's not bloodier violence.
They figured it out. I mean, it's not, you know, the roadmap for doing this is already out there. I mean, there are so many PG-13 rated action movies that you just don't have, you don't just show blood. You don't show any blood. That's it. And then you can do whatever you want.
It's worth noting that while Battle Royale was apparently controversial in Japan at the time, this film was released with the second highest rating, which is R15, which means you had to be 15 to go see it. It was not even the most restricted rating you could have for a film. And it's far more explicit than the Hunger Games film.
Oh, yeah, I should say
to say the least.
I would argue, though, Scott, that it's not necessarily more realistic violence. I think it's very sort of Tarantino-y violence. It's comic booky. I don't know that that's... I mean, I've never killed someone, so I can't say for sure.
You just stabbed them
but,
in the butt.
Right. But when you slice someone's throat, I don't think there's like a geyser of blood. I mean, again, not sure.
There's that, blood, though.
Right, of course. But I think it's takes it to the opposite extreme. I mean, one's sanitized and one's comic booky. I don't think that it's more realistic.
Well, yeah, I mean, part of the comic book affect of Battle Royale is people are constantly getting riddled with bullets and their bodies jerk around and they fall on the ground, like, covered with blood spots, but there aren't holes in their clothes mm-hmm. or their bodies. There's a very few, like, actual physical effects that are open wounds on people's bodies.
Right.
For the most part, it's just there's blood spattered everywhere. And by the end of the film, everybody just looks like they've been drenched in blood. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't feel, because it's blood that doesn't necessarily come from an obvious source, except in a few cases where somebody's like throat gets blown open, it makes it feel cartoonier.
Right.
It's like, again, it's like metaphor. It's a metaphorical blood. They're all steeped in metaphorical blood by the end of the movie. And like who that blood came from isn't as important right. as kind of the concept of blood.
And they're also, I mean, when the girls on the hill get shot and then they're like, we've always had a crush on you. Like, it's not real violence. I don't think it's any realer than the Hunger Games is. I think it's just a completely different type of violence.
No, but there's, I'm just saying, there's blood. That's ultimately
period.
What I'm saying.
Like,
that's
all
we need.
There will be blood.
You know, there's candor there in saying this is our premise and this is what the result of that premise is going to be. And I don't think that the same candor carries over in the Hunger Games.
I think the most telling point, the thing that kind of confirms everything you're saying is the way the death of Rue is handled in the first Hunger Games film, which is you know, bloodless and sort of like played as very, kind of like you'd see it if you saw it in a TV show or saw it in like a TV show that could air in prime time, very, you know, it's a sad moment, but there's nothing that really drives the impact of that home. And yeah, I get it. It's going to have to be a PG-13 film, but that's a compromise that's very evident in the film that actually made it to the screen.
Well, at the same time, I mean, what does drive the point home, unless you're a merciless racist, because there were people who said they couldn't mourn her because she was black, and it just kicked off this insane online controversy because people are idiots. But that aside,
and racist idiots too.
Yeah, super racist idiots. What brings it home is Jennifer Lawrence's performance around
sure.
her death. And, you know, she, I mean, these movies did amazing things for Jennifer Lawrence. They weren't her first films by a long shot, but they really, really boosted her profile as a superstar. And moments like that, like what we're supposed to be feeling in that moment is not, you know, oh my God, look at this child blown apart. It is what I was talking about when I spoke kind of mockingly of like the decorous, like, you know, sentimental violence. But at the same time, it's a place where what we're being told to feel is some very specific things, both around the loss, you know, rather than the violence. And I think that's one of the things that makes the Hunger Games series so distinctive from Battle Royale, because Battle Royale, we're constantly like lingering on the emotion of these individual kids, but all that emotion is so big and outsized and frenetic. Like the energy of the two movies is just so completely different.
Yeah, but imagine that moment with Jennifer Lawrence's performance and tons of blood.
I don't like that moment. I don't approve.
Scott would, in fact, have given that a big thumbs up. Just head to toe, like Carrie, drenched in blood.
Well, one of the points that I was making, though, in the first part of this podcast was how the scenario is made palatable in Battle Royale. And I think it takes a lot of creativity to do it, because in that film, it is violent, and you are seeing kids blow each other apart. And we're entertained by that somehow. And I feel like the way this does it is just not have violence, like not have true violence. And I feel like that's a pretty uncreative way of doing it. But what you're saying about emphasis is totally valid. I mean, I feel like I'm coming off pretty negative about the style-free, bloodless series, when in fact I actually like The Hunger Games, particularly the second movie, you know, quite a bit. So I don't mean to dismiss it entirely because of that, but I do feel like that's a fundamental issue that I have with the series.
But I mean, isn't a large part of the Hunger Games series exploring this idea of like voyeuristic enjoyment of violence? And the story itself is like looking at the people who experience this voyeuristic enjoyment of violence as, you know, shallow people who are part of a corrupt system that needs to be brought down. I think there is, and it's really hard to separate it from, because I think you're 100% right about the commercial choices being made to give the film a PG-13 rating. But at the same time, if the film was like full of like ghastly bodies being ripped apart and like really trying to double down on the violence and the grotesqueness of the violence, that it would be giving us the voyeuristic things that it's saying that we shouldn't be enjoying. I mean, it feels like that condemnation would become hypocritical if it was also like feeding our bloodlust at the same time it was condemning these people for their bloodlust.
Well, who's it condemning? I mean, you feel like whose bloodlust is being condemned?
Oh, everybody in the capital that sees the death of these teenagers as just as entertainment. I mean, one of the big tensions in the Hunger Games story is the tension between the people who are suffering and dying and the people who are seeing it as entertainment and not taking it seriously and not feeling the weight of it. I mean, the whole point of the capital as a system is that it's like a bunch of decadent people who are very divorced from the realities of life because everybody else in Pan Am is working to keep them like satisfied and rich and in the life of luxury and divorced from reality. And all of the districts are specifically being held down by the Hunger Games as a reminder of how little power they have.
But I guess my question is, are we to take the audience's reaction to what they're seeing differently? I mean, do the in terms of its value as this bread and circuses thing, do we see the people in the capital seeing it differently from the people in the other districts who might be perfectly excited about their people kind of triumphing and excited about people in rival districts not triumphing? I mean, do you see those audiences being different and being distracted in the same way? Because that's the whole idea of red circuses, is that distracts you from the fact that you're in this horrible, you're living in this horrible, objectionable totalitarian state.
Anybody else want to feel that before this becomes a me and Scott?
Yeah. I mean, it just sounds like sports to me.
Yeah, no, it is. No, we have the NFL. The NFL is basically the Hunger Games.
Right. People aren't forced to participate in the NFL. They're paid millions of dollars to play in the NFL.
Where are they?
Oh my God! Scott been enjoying a blood sport this whole time?
But we do accept chronic head injury and right. things like that, just because it's kind of this fun sport that we enjoy.
Yeah, I don't get that reading of it at all. I mean, we see the other districts, people in the other districts watching the Hunger Games at various times throughout the series, and they're clearly being compelled to be there at gunpoint. They're clearly watching the children of their district die on screen. With like an air of suffering and misery. They're mm-hmm. watching their children be executed for somebody's enjoyment as an indication of how powerless they are. And that, for me, is actually one of the big problems with Battle Royale is I like the element at the beginning where the journalists are showing up and making a circus of the whole thing, because supposedly the reason Battle Royale was created was to punish youth and to tell them to keep in their place. And if the youth of the nation don't know this is happening, like, how do you get there from there?
Yeah, I mean, that gets down to the whole thing where that's part of Battle Royale I don't buy. I don't see it as an effective tool for keeping the population oppressed, maybe in part because we never really leave the perspective of the kids or the island once they get there. You have the beginning and a couple of flashbacks, some of which are only in the director's cut, apparently. but it's a much more fleshed out world in the Hunger Games. And I do ultimately, you know, it's one of those things where if you think about it too much, perhaps it's going to fall apart. But I think as long as the film is on, I buy that this world works the way it works.
Well, a lot of that perspective of staying within the perspective of the kids on the island is like steeping yourselves in how they feel at every given moment. And Rachel, that was kind of what you wanted to talk about as a topic, was it not?
Yeah, I found it really fascinating how both movies are ostensibly about teenagers, and Battle Royale really feels like it's about teenagers and The Hunger Games doesn't. And that's something I never really noticed until I saw Battle Royale, just how, I mean, obviously you have adults playing teenagers in The Hunger Games, which is part of the problem, but I also think that they're not really... they don't act like teenagers. They're sort of incredibly competent most of the time. And I know they have training and all of that, but it just feels like they sort of accept their fates for the most part. Yeah, there's a little bit of romance thrown in, and yeah, there's some, you know, moments where they're a little bit ridiculous, but for the most part, they're very much just sort of really into it and sort of ignoring their hormones and emotions. Whereas in Battle Royale, the feelings are the whole point. The feelings mm-hmm. are front and center. They're being murdered and they're confessing their love for each other. You know, this girl's dying on a hill and she's telling, Noriko is telling telling Shuya that she's jealous that those girls who are now dead just confessed that they had a crush on him. I mean, it's absurd. And like the young girls who are in the lighthouse killing each other, that type of thing. I think it's so funny and it's so awkward and it's so self-aware. I mean, it is basically being a teenager. That movie is being a teenager in all of its glory. And The Hunger Games just isn't.
I think it makes sense, though, because the Hunger Games is about people who grew up in this world and like were always living that way. And part of the humor of Battle Royale comes from the fact that this is they're thrown in the situation one day after just being high schoolers, and you know, all these dramas that were already in progress when they were in high school just play out in this really heightened arena, which to me I think is where much of the humor of that film of Battle Royale comes from.
Yeah, that's exactly the point I was going to make as well, Keith. Is that you're just dealing with two different sets of kids, basically, because you know, in these kids in Battle Royale were in high school. They perhaps come from a more privileged or decadent, not quite decadent, but maybe more privileged backgrounds. They are in the middle, cliques that and rivalries and love sicknesses that existed. Before they enter the arena, are very much present and a factor when they enter the arena. But in the Hunger Games, you know, those are all none of the kids from the capital are fighting that fight. The kids who are fighting the fight live in districts where they don't have food, where they live a very austere life, where survival is day to day is paramount. So I think that makes sense that they don't necessarily act like teenagers.
Two points to make. So one, I think, is that what we were talking about earlier, which is the way that we're introduced to Battle Royale is we're introduced to a world where that does happen and it is covered and that is part of their existence. And they also are living in sort of a dystopia, which is what we're introduced to in the beginning. You know, there's unemployment and everybody's rioting and stabbing their teachers in the butt. And, you know, nothing's going well for them. You know, they live in a dystopia too. It's different, but it's still a dystopia. So then alternately, the Hunger Games, there are different districts and each of them have different forms of or levels of affluence. Some of them have very quote unquote normal lives. Some of them are eating, you know, and then forcing themselves to throw up and then eating again. So, I mean,
is that happening outside the Capitol? I don't remember.
Just the Capitol. But still, I mean, the point is that I think that there's more similarities to those worlds than you might believe. But I do think that, I mean, I get what you're saying, but I just think it's thinking about the Hunger Games now, I just find that I think it's sort of a weakness that they don't let the teenagers be sort of ridiculous sometimes.
Well, I mean, a lot of the thematic point of the Hunger Games series is that Katniss Everdeen specifically cannot afford to have emotions. Mm-hmm. Because of the world she's living in, she can't give into her own love for Gale. She can't give into, I mean, she gives into her love for her sister and it nearly kills her about a million times over and it upends her entire society. There's such a thread running through it of she's so traumatized, but she can't just curl up and be traumatized because she's got to be a leader. She can't love the person she loves. She has to pretend to love somebody else and on and on and on. And I think what's interesting and kind of fun and kind of crazy about Battle Royale is the sense that they can afford to have their emotions. And in fact, they can't afford not to have their emotions because they're about to die. So there's so much like packing so many things that they didn't say. One of those stranger moments in the film is the confession, the guy that uses his tracking device to go to his crush object and she promptly shoots him. And he's like, oh, well, I always loved you. And she's like, how was I supposed to know that? Right. You never said anything. And there's so many moments like that, which, by the way, is a big, big staple of anime. I've seen it in Japanese dramas, but way more so in anime dealing with teenagers.
Right.
That, do you like anybody? Like, that specific sentence. Like, do you like anybody? Do you have a crush on anybody right now? Like, just seems to be a staple of the genre. So, like, seeing it played out here in these big operatic moments, like, I think it's such a difference between the two in terms of like what people feel they're allowed to do with their emotions.
You know what I will say though, thinking about it, Katniss is definitely a teenager. She's definitely a teenager. I mean, it maybe came through a little bit more strongly for me in the books than the movie, but there's constant uncertainty. There's constant mixed emotions. There's kind of this swirl of just of calculation and also feeling, you know, with regard to the sort of love triangle that she's in the middle of. So I feel like that is amplified in a very teenagery kind of a way, even though it's not as playful, I guess, as or as silly or they don't screw, you know, she doesn't screw up quite as much as teenagers tend to, but I think that kind of feeling of that she's a little bit unformed, that she's dealing with a lot of emotions, that she's in this love triangle. I mean, I feel like that's a big hook to that, to those books, beyond, you know, this dystopian world that it's trying to set up. So in that sense, perhaps it's a little bit teenagery.
I agree. In the book, she definitely reads as a teenager. I don't know that it translates to the film as much. Maybe it's just hard to separate Jennifer Lawrence from Katniss sometimes, because she, I mean, even though she's sort of this jocular figure in the media, I think she does seem very sort of wise beyond her years and hyper competent. So maybe that's part of it too. But I don't know that that inner monologue is really translated as much in the films.
Rachel, since this is your topic, I'm curious what you make of how the two films handle trauma. Because I like, one of the things I said kind of in the intro was a Battle Royale feels to me like much more about the immediate human cost of all of this violence, whereas like The Hunger Games kind of explores it over a long period of time, but in a very different way. And I'm sort of curious what you make of the contrast there.
Yeah, I mean, there's very little, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think there's a lot of emotional trauma that occurs in Battle Royale. I mean, if anything, the emotions, like we talked about, are very much about like lust and feelings for each other. And it doesn't appear that there, I mean, I think Shuya cries a few times when people die, which is, every time he got upset, I was like, why are you upset again? Like, you know, this is what's happening. I was gonna like, get over it, dude. But yeah, you're right. In The Hunger Games, there's a lot of time spent on just sort of her mental state and her mental health. And there's really no regard for anyone's mental health in Battle Royale.
I think there's also an element of, you know, kind of societal trauma that feeds into these films too, where Battle Royale was, the, you know, produced in the middle of Japan's, what came to be known as Japan's lost decade, which was the 1990s on into the early 21st century, where here was a nation that was kind of poised to take over the world economically in the 1980s, and then the economy stagnated. And, you know, this first Hunger Games film came out in 2008, which is the year of our own economic collapse, but at the end of a long period of economic uncertainty, the war, the dot-com burst. I think that, you know, the certain amount of an instability kind of feeds into, inspires these sorts of fictions and allows them to thrive.
I mean, all that makes me think of is the degree to which, like, The Hunger Games kind of feels like an answer to the Occupy movement, and like how far away the story has come from that. Like, the first one really kind of felt like it was rooted in the politics of its time. And as we get further and further away from that, it feels more and more like an abstract war story to me.
Yeah, I agree. I was thinking the same thing with, it feels like it originally set out to be sort of a commentary on our current day. And then it just sort of wandered away from that. And now it's not really saying much of anything about the current political moment that we're in.
But it will. That's the thing about The Hunger Games, is that it's such a riff on how totalitarian systems have worked throughout history that it will be applied. It may not be something we can apply to a situation in the world in 2015, but at some point we're gonna see some society and think, man, Hunger Games got that right.
Well, if Mockingjay Part 2 in any way involves drones or drone cameras, everybody's going to say it's all about drone strikes, because that, it feels like that's been, like, for the past 10 years, that's what every movie has been quote-unquote secretly about. And I feel like we've said all we need to say about drone strikes, specifically via, like, YA dystopic fantasies. Just briefly, I think it's worth talking about. My theoretical topic was just sort of like the YA genre and like how it's changed since these movies, and how it's changed in part as a result of these movies. I do feel that we're seeing an awful lot of movies these days that are like violent dystopias about young people overturning oppressive regimes, because The Hunger Games were such big bestsellers that a whole bunch of other people wrote stories like that, and many of them are also becoming movies, which is where you're getting your, I mean, I think The Giver finally got made after Jeff Bridges trying to make it for more than a decade, because somebody said, yeah, if you kind of squint and cock your head to the side, I guess we could find a way to make it about teenagers fighting like a dystopic oppressive regime instead of what the book's really about. But it does seem to me like we're finally kind of clearing the leading edge of that wave, and we're finally starting to get more and more stories about teenagers that aren't about teenage heroes fighting in a depressive landscape. I'm curious whether any of that, the wave that followed Hunger Games, like hit home for you, whether you think any of these like make for good movies or good stories.
I've largely avoided it, in part because, you know, it was a matter of me not grabbing the review. We were sending reviews and then and not hearing great things about it. I feel like I should catch up. I feel like I should catch up with the Divergent series because it's filmed here in post-apocalyptic Chicago.
Jenny was shaking her head violently enough that we might actually be able to hear
one hour of Divergent, and I was like, I must stop.
Well, I would be based on, again, Divergent would be the only one I have seen and could comment on, but Divergent will definitely show you how good The Hunger Games is in terms of just laying out the world and making sense of the world, because the world of Divergent and the way the whole thing works is beyond dumb. So in that sense, The Hunger Games is much more thoughtfully laid out, you know, whereas Divergent is this very strange, nonsensical, no government could ever work this way kind of system that's all built around the possibility of a chosen one type. Who is a Divergent, right? Isn't it called? All right. Anyway. I would argue for maybe checking out a couple of the other YA films just as a way to appreciate what The Hunger Games does right.
I mean, Divergent is a slightly fun film to watch if you're in Chicago, like we all are, because so much of it was shot in Chicago. And it's like, much like the third Transformers movie, it's been plastered over with CGI so heavily that it's almost unrecognizable. But like, there's still the bones of that city there. But yeah, like narratively, I thought the first film was a mess, and I think the best thing
about Divergent is that it just destroys Navy Pier. Navy Pier is just wiped out.
I like the IMAX. I like Chicago Shakespeare Theater. These you know, the Ferris.
What about Bubba Gump Shrimp?
I haven't eaten that.
What about the McDonald's that looks like kind of a Roman McDonald's?
Yeah.
I think the best thing about Divergent is it accurately reflects the dystopia that is Chicago, like we were just talking about.
Yeah, where they don't screen movies on time.
This place would not be such a dystopia if you would stop running around stabbing people in the butt, Rachel.
I can't help it. It's my calling.
Okay.
I'm a Divergent.
All right. Well, when the Battle Royale scenario happens, I want to be on your team as long as you have teams going. But I'm not turning my butt on you at any point.
Oh my God.
All right. Mockingjay Part 2 opens wide in American release on November 20th, and if the other installments in the series are any indication, it'll be in theaters for quite a while to come. So you'll have plenty of opportunities to see whether it follows in the footsteps of the predecessors we've discussed here. The first three Hunger Games movies are streaming on Amazon, with the second and third free for Prime members, and they're all on DVD Blu-ray. Battle Royale is streaming on Netflix, on Amazon Video, and many other pay services, and it's available on DVD or in a massive four-disc Blu-ray set from Anchor Bay. Keith, would you recommend that as an owner of that set?
I don't have the set. I just have the single Blu-ray.
Oh, but the single Blu-ray apparently has the director's cut full of footage that none of the rest of us have seen.
That I may have just made up.
All right, well, we highly recommend everybody buys that and find out whether Keith is telling the truth. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We're calling the segment Your Next Picture Show in the hopes that it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Keith, you want to kick us off? What in the film world has been good for you lately?
I don't want to break format, but I haven't really seen that much lately that I want to bring into the table to recommend. But
lately is a very broad thing.
Well, in the last year or so, I watched a film that kind of relates to this, called Over the Edge, which is a 1979 drama directed by Jonathan Kaplan, who's otherwise best known for the making The Accused. But it's filmed in like sort of suburban Colorado, and it is about unattended youth and the trouble they get into just kind of wandering around and not having good parental role models. And it starts off as, you know, fairly unnerving film, and it goes to some very strange extreme places, not quite Battle Royale level extreme, but definitely something to recommend. Another good pairing for Battle Royale or The Hunger Games, I guess. And it features a young Matt Dillon and some fine songs by Cheap Trick on the soundtrack.
I have not seen it. Have either of you guys?
No.
All right, so we all need to take Keith's recommendation. Yeah, that's a deep cut. Scott, what do you have for us?
I have a film called James White. James White is a film that is directed by Josh Mond. It's his first film, but he is part of the Borderline Films Collective, which includes Antonio Campos, who did After School, and Simon Killer, and Sean Durkin, who did Martha, Marcy May, Marlene. This is his first film. It's a very personal film. It's about kind of the screw-up who's just getting over the death of his father, who's been kind of absent, but his mother, who has had cancer before, she relapses, and he has to sort of take care of her. And he leads a very irresponsible sort of hedonistic lifestyle. He has kind of this fight or flight response to this very difficult situation, and he kind of goes through with it, and it's done with great austerity and intensity. I mean, the Borderline Films guys definitely have that Michael Haneke influence, and this is sort of like their Amour, I guess would be the comparable thing. But it's much, it's not nearly as cold as Amour. It's as honest as Amour, but it's very, very emotional. And Christopher Abbott, who people know from Girls, he's the lead, and he's basically, he's a young Marlon Brando. I mean, he's got that bruised masculinity, and it's a heartbreaking film. I mean, it absolutely just crushed me, and I think it's got a lot of integrity. And, you know, I know people kind of shy away from cancer narratives or shy away from things that are hard to watch, but I think it's very much worth going through, because it's just a great movie.
Scott Tobias, always going for the trauma. Rachel?
So I just interviewed Lake Bell for Up Rocks. Oh, nice. Shout out for Keith right there.
I hear good things about this Up Rocks.
Right? She was delightful. And I to interview her, I watched her movie, which is coming out in the U.S. this weekend, so November 13th. Man Up. It's a rom-com. It's British.
Oh, I saw that at Tribeca.
I thought it was just charming as hell. It's an all British cast except for her, and she does an impeccable British accent. And I don't know if you guys have seen the show Catastrophe on Amazon, with Rob Delaney and Sharon Horgan, but Sharon Horgan plays Lake Bell's sister, and she's fantastic. And it was just very exciting to see her in a movie. And it's just like a cute little, you know, very self-aware rom-com. It's very earnest. It's very, very funny. It doesn't really try to undermine the genre at all, or sort of change anything about it. It's just a straight rom-com. It's really good. It's kind of rare that you find just like a really great rom-com. It's about a woman named Nancy who meets Simon Pegg by accident when she pretends to be his blind date, also by accident, and hilarity ensues. It was just very charming and delightful.
Yeah, co-signed. I am not a rom-com fan at all. And I went to see that because I was just curious, and I really like Lake Bell. I really like Simon Pegg. And it really surprised me.
Yeah, me too.
It's one of those films that kind of walks an interesting line between playing with the genre and playing it straight. Mm-hmm. And it's like a really rare rom-com that that setup is super, super gimmicky. It's, but the film doesn't feel gimmicky.
No, it doesn't. And the writing is really good. It's written by Tess Morris, a woman. And I went in thinking, oh, this is gonna be so like cheesy and silly, and you know, it was silly, but it was just adorable. I loved it, and like Belle's amazing.
It's good to see movies that are actually worthy of her now, because there's like the longest time where it's like, man, she's the best thing about Over Her Dead Body. But what about you, Tasha? What did you like? What do you have to recommend?
I'm actually going to recommend the Peanuts movie, which I saw in the theaters. And that movie has kind of gotten a rough row to hoe. Like the reviews of that have been a little bit mixed. And I've gotten into it on Twitter with a few people, including our old AV Club intern, Kevin McFarlane, who's now a writer at Wired and who hated that movie for reasons that normally would be triggers for me. Like the fact that it's all about this sad sack who can't talk to a girl and how he can win her through like doing cool things around her. There are a bunch of ways you could pick this movie apart sort of conceptually, and none of them bothered me, because in the end, it's a movie about Charlie Brown. You know, it's a movie about these characters that have been so familiar for so long, that are so much part of the culture. And I was really dreading going in and having like an Alvin and the Chipmunks experience, you know, because they've CGI'd an experience like the new Muppet Show, where they're trying so hard to like sex it up and make drug jokes and make it edgy. I was expecting something like that. And what I got was something that could have come out on TV in the 1970s, except that it's visually beautiful in the manner of a 2015 CGI film. They're so respectful to the tone of the classic things that people our age grew up with. They're so respectful to the characters, and they're really respectful to Charles Schulz's art. I think it's fascinating how they created these like 3D rounded CGI characters, but then they used Schulz's lines just throughout the art, especially in drawing their faces. Animation-wise, it's a really, really interesting hybrid. And narratively, it's a really cool like throwback to things that I have fond memories of. Am I the only person that's seen this movie?
I think I'm going to see it this weekend.
Yeah. You seem kind, really, more than me.
Yeah, no. I mean, when I read the reviews, I kind of like, phew, because I want to take my daughter to it. I don't want to take her to a bad Peanuts thing. I want her to like Peanuts, you know?
Well, and I think that, it's a relief to hear you say that you like it, because I think you, like myself, have a kind of a Blue Sky Studios allergy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they did Ice Age and Rio and those type of movies, which are just these really sort of bright, garish, you know, star voice filled joke fests.
Very vaguely shrill, unpleasant.
Yeah, and which seems so off for what Peanuts is at its core, but you're saying that they've got it right.
Well, here's the other thing. Like, longtime friend of all of us, Noel Murray, I think, like, pegged the Ice Age movies in a way that I'd never understood before he wrote about how essentially those movies are about a bunch of, like, 40-something dad types that are worried about, like, whether they're still cool. And, like, you get all of this, like, thing with Scrat the squirrel running around that's aimed at, like, 4-year-olds, and then you get this narrative about, you know, am I, aging, balding movie executive, still a cool dude? And, you know, Noel was always just like, what exactly does this have to say to children? The Peanuts movie is a movie for children. It's a movie that I think parents can appreciate on a nostalgic level, but it's not constantly firing jokes over the kids' heads. The two of you who have small girls, like, I am so curious what you make of the film, and I'm also super, super curious what the kids make of the film. So I'm really hoping that we can hear about that at some point.
Well, my daughter liked Hotel Transylvania too, so
they liked everything. I can pretty much tell you that they're gonna like it.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of The Next Picture Show. We'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion on Battle Royale, the Hunger Games series, or both, and what you'd like to see from this podcast going forward. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. In the meantime, where can we find everyone these days, Rachel?
My Twitter is @Rachel_Handler. And I'm writing in a lot of places. I'm writing at Uproxx, Vanity Fair, Vulture. I was writing at Grantland, RIP.
Well, until there's even more Rachel Keith, where can we find you?
Mostly at Uproxx these days, where I'm editing and writing there. I had a big piece in The Verge about midnight movies a couple weeks ago that people
good
might
stuff.
Enjoy checking out. And that's
good.
And I'm on Twitter at KFIPS3000.
I'm at @Scott_Tobias. I'm writing for NPR, Variety, New York Times, Washington Post, Rolling Stone, Oscilloscope, etc. So a bunch of places.
I'm on Twitter at Tasha Robinson, and you can find my work at NPR, The Verge, and a lot of other places. Like Scott, I'm kind of all over these days. You can stay updated on The Next Picture Show via Twitter at @NextPitcherPod or by visiting nextpictureshow.net. Thanks again to Genevieve Kosky for producing the show. You can find her on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky. And thanks to FilmSpotting for all their help, input, and support. We hope you'll tune in next time when we'll be talking about Pixar's latest animated story, The Good Dinosaur, and we'll go back to the beginning of Pixar with the company's first feature, 1995's Toy Story. Remember, you've got a friend in us.